Hello and welcome to the new season of the MIT Press Podcast. My name is Chris Gondak, and today I'll be speaking with Richard DeMillo, the author of Abelard to Apple, The Fate of American Colleges and Universities. Richard DeMillo is Distinguished Professor of Computing and Professor of Management, former John P. Imlay Dean of Computing, and Director for the Center for 21st Century Universities at Georgia Institute of Technology. Author of over 100 articles, books, and patents, he has held academic positions at Purdue University, the University of Wisconsin, and the University of Padua. He directed the Computer and Computation Research Division of the National Science Foundation and was Hewlett-Packard's first chief technology officer. Richard DeMillo, thanks so much for being on the MIT Press podcast today.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, the University of California and the University of Texas systems are two fairly highly regarded public university systems. But in the last year, California's raised tuition enough to bring on a lot of student protest. And Governor Perry, who's currently running for the Republican nomination, has made it quite clear he wants to see major changes in Texas higher education, including a $10,000 college degree. Are these just signs of the new austerity hitting higher education, or are the different forces at work here?
Not different forces. The same economic and political forces that shape other institutions, I think. You know, Tom Friedman is famous for saying that it's a flat world, and universities have been slow to consider how they should work in a world that's been flattened by globalization and technology. Universities, I think, are subject to the same forces as other institutions, but you'd never know it if you spent your time in faculty lounges. Nevertheless, it's true. I think the Texas and California situations are really very different aspects of that. In Texas, you see an agenda like trying to measure the productivity of university faculty in the same way that you would measure factory productivity, which I think is fundamentally a wrong-headed approach. It really misses the mark. In California, you see a systematic attempt to dismantle an investment that's made the state wealthy. California, even today, is the eighth largest economy in the world. The difference is that in California, the university system took on the challenge of a huge budget reduction to begin the process of reengineering how they deliver value. I have to say I'm much more skeptical of the Texas approach. Why is $10,000 the right number? Is that what it takes to produce a college graduate? Is that what it takes to impart skills? What's the value of a $10,000 degree? Without looking at value, it just seems like a naked political move.
So could you explain a little bit or flesh out that whole idea about measuring the productivity in the academic world as they do in the private sector? Where's the disconnect there?
The disconnect is that things like productivity are measured in terms of hours spent in the classroom. Those are input measures. And we know that input measures have virtually no effect on the value that's produced, even in factories, I have to say. So you don't know, for example, what the long-term impact is of a professor and a student's success, career success. Hours in the classroom may not be the way to measure that, any more than dollars spent per student or selectivity is a way to measure that.
The really opening theme of the book talks about how there's this schism between what the university values and what the student values, and in fact that the universities are kind of missing the boat about how student valuations are changing. So from the university's point of view, is it fair to say that they're more kind of a church in that they see themselves as we're a university, the values that we espouse are timeless and unchanging, and all the rest of the stuff is just kind of, I guess you call it, noise within the historical process, and we know we're right? Or is it more kind of like Congress? It's like people know that there's change needed. It's not that what they're doing is going to be good forever, but there are entrenched political forces which make it really hard to change, even though there's an awareness that things have to be different.
Well, this is really a very, very old argument. You can go back to people like John Henry Newman in the 1850s, the guy who founded the oldest and largest university in Ireland, and was a leading philosopher and literary figure of his day. And he was famous for saying that a university that's been doing useless things for a long time at first finds it degrading to be useful. And I think that's sort of the dialectic that you find in universities throughout history. Today, there are people, I think mainly in the humanities, unfortunately, who argue that it degrades the value of a liberal arts education to have to talk about its value. They would argue that it's the cultivation of the intellect that defines value and that nothing more needs to be said. So I'm the product of a liberal arts education, and that's what I heard throughout my undergraduate years. The problem with that is that today there's a price tag that's attached to that liberal arts diplomas. You know, student debt is rising to unsustainable levels. And at some point, we in academia start to look like Henry Hill. We're selling shiny band uniforms and trombones to the rubes in River City if we don't start explaining why a family should go $250,000 in debt to play in Henry Hill's band. And that's the fundamental problem that we're facing. Now the change question that you mentioned is really an interesting one. Universities do change. Sometimes they change rapidly. When the medieval European universities became viewed as what was called in the day the ossified keepers of outmoded knowledge, at the end of the Renaissance, the Jesuits swept in southern Europe with a new way of doing business and set up a global network of universities that challenged the existing academic order. And that's a story that's repeated throughout history. In the U.S., colonial universities were the poor cousins of Oxford and Cambridge until after the Civil War. And then we as a nation began to question the value of a classical European education. And what was the result of that? Thousands of experiments. Many of the new colleges that were invented in the late 19th century were doomed to fail. But that was a wave of innovation. We got Williams, we got Johns Hopkins, we got Mills, Harvard innovated, we got the land-grant colleges. The pace of change in the late 19th century was really, really staggering. And then at the start of the 20th century, we got a new wave of innovation. And now we're sitting at the beginning of a new century and looking back 100 years and saying, so what's happened to American universities over the last century? And it's interesting because it was almost exactly 100 years ago that the first rankings of universities was published. And the most striking thing to me in looking at the rankings from 1910 was that it was an equal mix of public and private universities. Public universities were small, they were wealthy, they were successful. Today you look at reputational rankings of universities, not a single public university is in the top 20. So what's happened? I contend that experimentation stopped. So it's really not that change is resisted, it's that the great experiments have stopped in the U.S.
They've stopped as far as public universities, but I graduated in 1990, and although there certainly were for-profit colleges back then, I mean, you could get on television and you'd see commercials for ITT Tech. I mean, now, thinking of the 21st century, there are a lot more for-profit colleges, and it seems that with technology, particularly the internet, they're able to make that cost delivery to the student. Getting back to the question of student value, because you do divide the university system, higher education in America, between the elites, the middle, and then what we'll call the for-profits. And I use the University of Phoenix just as an example because they're definitely the biggest, but there are other ones. That group in the middle, there's still envy of them, of the elites, but is there a backwards looking? Do they realize exactly what's happening to the for-profit colleges eating away would have been their student base, say, 20 years ago?
No, and this is really one of the critical factors that I talk about in the book when we look forward to what's going to happen over the next century. Whether or not the existing for-profit universities succeed or their model is adopted, it's pretty clear that they have a handle on value that somehow balances the cost of delivery with the attractiveness of programs to potential students. And the danger is that the existing universities, particularly the ones in the middle that don't feel that they have the freedom to create their own agenda, will look at that and say, well, that's much lower quality than we are. It's not a legitimate institution, and ignore those forces. So in your first question, for example, I said that in faculty lounges, you would not get a sense that there's anything going on globally in technology. That's one of the ways that it shows up in university thinking. There's a tendency, for example, to value an imagined classroom experience much more than an imagined online experience. And of course, the imagination is always that the classroom experience is a warm wonderful nurturing experience, and the online experience is cold and dispassionate, which is untrue as often as it's true.
MIT has all of its courses online and available, and I have taken a couple of the Open Yale courses, and they're pretty interesting, and I like them a lot. I mean, you certainly can't get graded from Yale, but you can pick up a lot. Can you see a day when a university, and I pick MIT and Yale just because they're the two that came to mind, but I know there are other universities who are doing this, and I don't want to limit it to those elite schools that, like Yale and MIT, but can you see a day when a university decides to completely give up any kind of physical plant, and I guess by a university who has a physical plant at this time, and just move to an internet-only system of classroom delivery?
I think there will be some that do that. What you see really going on today are hybrids and federations of universities that are pooling resources for online delivery. The research on this is very, very young, but all indications are that students learn best when they're presented with a mix of online and in-person instruction. The real question is, where is the value of the in-person instruction? We just have a real strong feeling in traditional U.S. institutions that sitting in a darkened classroom and you know, watching a professor 50 yards away on a stage is the way to deliver information, and there's really no reason to believe that. If you look at the title of my book, it talks about Abelard and Apple, and Apple is the metaphor for the 21st century. It's the metaphor for online delivery. It's the metaphor for scalability. Who was Abelard? Peter Abelard was, in addition to being you know, the person who was involved in this famous love affair with Heloise, was really the first professor in Europe. He was a charismatic figure that drew students by the thousands because he would engage them in dialectics. He would engage them in controversial topics. That's a two-way street, and you don't get that in a sage on a stage classroom. You really need to have one-on-one interaction. So when I look at a bricks and mortar institution, I'm not imagining a darkened English 101 classroom filled with 300 students. What I'm imagining is much more like what in the 21st century will be the replacement for the one-on-one interaction with students. And that may be a combination of online delivery, a really sophisticated way of having a single professor and his or her assistants reach many students. And most importantly, and I think this is really one of the innovations in the last 10 years, the rise of social networks. So we know that peer communities are very, very important. When Chuck Vest invented the idea of OpenCourseWare, he was very clear to say the material that we're putting on the internet is not an MIT education. An MIT education consists of the learning community in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're now in a position when we can spread through social networking learning communities on a global scale, and that is really a way to bring in peers, tutoring, mentoring at a scale that you can't do in a bricks and mortar institution. I think at some point you have to talk about cost. What is the value of a bricks and mortar institution when all of the cost is going towards fancy football stadiums and dormitories? That is value that really doesn't end up in the classroom, and that seems to be the direction that American institutions have been pushing for the last generation.
From the MIT courseware, that I get a sense they've been surprised by the number of self-organized learning communities that have been asking them for more work. Didn't you say that there are groups in Africa that are going through the MIT coursework and sending requests back for more information for what did I miss from this lecture?
I have a colleague who started a website called Open Study, and he actually spun off a company called OpenStudy.com that tries to organize on a global scale these learning communities. So if you're taking the introductory algebra course from iTunes U, you can go on Open Study and find all of the students in the world that are taking that course at the same time. And once you engage in that community, what do you find? You find the professor there, certainly, But most importantly, you find a peer group. So you find people that are at different levels of learning the material. You find, like in any other social network, people that have assumed positions of responsibility. In a sense, social capital is created and passed back and forth in these online communities in ways that you really can't duplicate in a bricks and mortar institution. And we're just at the beginning stages of this kind of revolution. I think it's going to be very interesting over the next 10 years to see how this plays out.
Rich DeMillo, the author of Abelard to Apple, The Fate of American Colleges and Universities. Thanks so much for being on the MIT Press podcast today.
Thank you, Chris.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at mitpress.mit.edu. Don't forget the MIT Press is on Facebook at www.facebook.com/MIT Press. Or you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at MIT Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the MIT Press podcast. Copyright 2011, the MIT Press. All rights reserved.